Peace, family. This is Davon Love, Director of Public Policy, Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. I'm here with my good friend, Dr. Tara Bynum. We're going to talk about Baltimore. We're going to talk about advocacy and a whole lot of other things. This is In Search of Black Power. It's our podcast to really, you know, have some conversation about, you know, just some of the things that are needed when we talk about Black empowerment, Black liberation. So this is one of those conversations that hopefully can be helpful, you know, in the work that folks are doing. So how you doing, Dr. Bynum?
Oh, my goodness. I'm doing well, and I'm excited to be here. Thank you so much for having me, Davon.
Yeah. And I appreciate you for accepting the invitation. So one of the things that I love about talking to Dr. Bynum is that she is from Baltimore and is proudly from Baltimore. And so this is one of those conversations where, you know, we get to nerd out a little bit about Baltimore and about how we think about Baltimore, how Baltimore is represented. Before we do that, though, I just want to give you an opportunity to introduce yourself, talk about your work, and anything else you want people to know about what you do.
Well, I am Dr. Tara Bynum, as Davon has said. I am an assistant professor of English and African American Studies at the University of Iowa, and I am Baltimore born and raised. I feel like I rep the city as hard as I can, especially in these Midwest streets that I find myself right this second. And, you know, what's funny, as I was thinking about this conversation, I thought about, like, my family's long history in Baltimore. So, you know, I think my mother's side goes back far, like into the 19th century in Baltimore. Wow. So, you know, it's a city that I can talk entirely too much about. So I'm looking forward to the conversation ultimately.
Yeah, that's what's up. That's what's up. And just a disclaimer for those watching, I'm not an asshole. I had a medical condition while I'm wearing these sunglasses. So I don't want y'all talking bad about me because I got these sunglasses on. So just want to make sure that's on the record. You know what I mean? Tara can vouch for me. You know what I mean?
It's true.
I needed that on the record. All right, so let's jump into it. So I remember some of the conversations you and I had during the Baltimore uprising in 2015, you know, because that was a moment where Baltimore, I think, not entered the national stage, because certainly there are representations of Baltimore that go back a while. And, you know, you talk about The Wire or The Corner and all these other, you know, kind of representations of Baltimore. But I think in terms of the moment of activism as a national thing, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement, as, you know, as it's been called, you know, Baltimore gets thrust into those conversations through the killing of Freddie Gray and the uprising that came after that. And again, you know, you and I would have conversations that for me were helpful and refreshing, because while, you know, a lot of people are having conversations about, you know, the kinds of oppression and suffering that Black people face, I've always found that there isn't enough attention paid to the impact that some of those narratives can have, right? In particularly in terms of how the challenges of Baltimore are talked about and discussed, right? And so to that end, if you could just talk a little bit about, like, what are some of the most troubling ways that you see or observe Baltimore being just talked about or represented, particularly by those who see themselves as being helpful in illuminating many of the structural challenges that we face in Baltimore. And I'm thinking along the lines of, like, again, conversations we've had about, like, this whole disaster porn or, like, this helpless Negro syndrome. You know, what is your observation of how some of these representations of Baltimore, particularly in the kind of social justice context, some of the troubling ways that Baltimore is represented?
You know, I think that the thing that comes most immediately to mind is the Baltimore that I saw on the national news during Freddie Gray and the aftermath of what happened. Like, it was not the Baltimore that I recognized. And the funny thing is that, like, you know, I feel like I've been all over Baltimore. I certainly grew up in a Baltimore during the crack era, the AIDS epidemic. Like, I have seen definitely some parts of Baltimore and lived through, you know, kind of parts of Baltimore's history that are, you know, at best harrowing, at worst, a whole bunch of other stuff. And yet, watching the news reports, even talking to friends that were elsewhere in the country or even abroad, like, what's happening there? Like, you know, I'm not sure I see the city that I know that has the people in it that I also know and grew up with. And I think that is what, like, consistently strikes me about Baltimore's representation. And I think that part of what I would say about the media's representation of Baltimore is that it oftentimes lacks nuance. You know, it almost lacks the human part of the story. You know, so I remember when I was working at Towson, I had a colleague who was from Canada and was new to Towson and new to Baltimore. And she was, I think it might have been her first or second year when the uprising happens in 2015. And so, you know, we're having these conversations and, you know, I'm the resident Baltimorean for her in these moments, especially like Black Baltimore. And she has this map, I think, this map of poverty that she has encountered. And she's kind of talking about this map of poverty and the way that it looks, the entire city is deeply impoverished. And, you know, I said to her that what's funny is that my family had a home long before I was born on Stricker Street. And that home was owned by my grandmother's brother, my Uncle Freddie. And Uncle Freddie, according to my mother, was the rich uncle. He had been in the military. He had a job at Social Security. And he owned a home. And he owned multiple homes, as a matter of fact, on Stricker Street in Walbrook Junction. I think he had a car, which was a big deal. He also had a phone when not everybody had phones on the block. So like he might have been the house on the block with the phone. So like he has all of these markers of wealth. When he dies in 1991 as a 70-year-old man, when my mother and her brothers are going through his paperwork, they learn that he's maybe a GS-3 at his Social Security job. And, you know, I don't know what the salary was in 1991, but let's just say that the GSs go up to 15, I think.
Right.
So as a 70-year-old man, he's at a 3 and is nowhere near a 15. So by, I guess, like just tax-related data, he's not a rich man at all. And quite the contrary. And yet he's got 2 houses. He still has a car. He still has a house phone. Like, you know, and there's a whole set of conversations that we can have about like systemic oppression, education, et cetera, that might kind of mark my Uncle Freddie's life. But I also think that we have to sit with the reality that he may be in. And I remember that the colleague's map, the impoverished places were purple. Like he might have lived in a purple place, but that doesn't actually help us understand his story. And I think that so often in the way that the media represents Baltimore, we miss that texture. We miss that nuance. We miss the fact that Uncle Freddie figured out how to own many things while not earning a lot of money. So I guess we could say that he was a poor man, but according to my mother, like that was her rich uncle. And I think that probably according to his sister, my grandmother, that was her rich brother, you know?
Mm-hmm. And so just to drill down a little bit more into particularly, you know, these representations that you describe, like with your Uncle Freddie, depending on how you look at it, you know, one, you know, could put him in that purple spot, but that doesn't describe the sum total of it. You know, in terms of his role in the life of your mother, it wouldn't compute. If we could drill down a little deeper, what would you say is the impact of that? Like, what is the impact of the lack of nuance that you're describing, where people would reduce Uncle Freddie to just all what they say the purple is? How would you describe the impact of that? Like, how would you describe like what that does?
Well, you know, I think at base, the impact is it means I get a whole lot of questions outside of Baltimore about what Baltimore is and looks like. I mean, my favorite was, do you live on the wire? Like, it's a TV show on HBO. Like, stand down. I don't know how one lives on it either. Like, this is, come on, like, get that out of here. I think the other thing that also happens is there's this weird way in which Baltimore itself doesn't seem to understand enough about what it offers. And enough about what it has going on kind of culturally, interpersonally. Like, yeah, I think that there's so much richness in Baltimore, literally and figuratively and in all the ways that richness happens. But I don't think that that is enough of the story. And I think that there's something, too, that also makes the kind of tragic Baltimore sellable, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think that there's been a leaning into the tragedy of Baltimore just because it's marketable. Like, how many HBO documentaries are there about Baltimore at this point?
Right.
Like, HBO, I mean, I think we all need checks from HBO, the amount of documentaries that have come through that all kind of have very similar sorts of stories. Like, it's a hard place to live. It's the hardest place to live, you know. And while it is certainly a city and a city that has, you know, challenges to it in the way that cities do, I guess I'm just struck by the fact that, like, do we have to lean into the challenge of it? Do we have to help HBO make a new documentary every other year, every third year, every fifth year? I mean, I guess it gets tricky because if HBO is cutting you a check, then, you know, you might be like, well, let me show you the hard side of these Baltimore streets. Let me not, you know, show you that there are other things kind of going on. Yeah.
I mean, for me, one of the things that the dynamic you're describing, one of the things that it does bolster are these notions of Black inferiority and pathology.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? This idea that Black people are best understood through our pathology. And I think that to the point where notions of Blackness are associated with pathology. And I know, like, in my work, one of the ways that shows up is many of the solutions to the challenges in Baltimore are often talked about in terms of saving us from our inherent pathology, as opposed to building on, you know, what has been done and what does exist as the basis for how we address a lot of these problems. What are some narratives? What are some narratives about Baltimore that you would say are overlooked, or just some aspects of Baltimore that are overlooked by this, you know, dominant narrative that you talked about earlier?
One that comes to mind most immediately is that Baltimore had the largest free Black population in the country. If we go back in time. And, you know, I say that as somebody who often spends time in the 18th century. That's where my research is. That's, you know, I like to know what Black people are doing in the 18th century, sometimes in the 19th, but not as much. So if we go back in time in this way, like, Baltimore has had this longstanding free Black population for a long time. And I think the only city that challenges that number is New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, you know, Baltimore and New Orleans end up kind of, you know, fighting this out statistically. So with that in mind, what's also interesting is that Baltimore has had this longstanding history of Black people creating their own organizations and using those organizations to establish the power they need to affect change in their communities, but also to establish those communities, to make those communities fruitful, to generate all kinds of culture, political activism, all sorts of things that communities do, schools, you know, I think there's literacy, you know, ensuring that there's literacy within the community, all of these things. And I don't think that gets talked about ever, kind of, you know. And, you know, I think as a consequence that it, I guess, often feels like Baltimore doesn't quite have a longstanding history of Black power, you know, and I mean Black power in, you know, maybe not in the 1970s sense, but actually just like Black people have had power in the city in, you know, maybe hyper-local ways, like just knowing that, you know, the various churches and mutual aid societies, et cetera, were able to do a thing. And also, and, you know, I think larger ways too. And I think that there are various examples of this. You know, I think most recently I've been reading about the development of the Roland Park neighborhood. Paige Glotzer, who got a PhD from Johns Hopkins, has this great book, How the Suburbs Were Segregated, I believe it's called. And it largely is about the development of Roland Park as a neighborhood. And, you know, Roland Park does not want Black people in its neighborhood at all. I think that is very well documented in yesteryear and also present day to some extent.
And for those who aren't familiar, just for you to talk a little bit about like what Roland Park is.
Roland Park is a neighborhood that I guess is in kind of the north and central area of Baltimore City. It kind of begins in the late 1890s. And the idea is that developers want to, and it's an international cohort of developers, want to establish homes for white people in what was then the suburbs of Baltimore. And the promise was that the homes would kind of carry them away from the various forms of blight. And oftentimes the various forms of blight meant Black people and, you know, other things. Baltimore was late to get a sewer, you know, so there's also those sets of concerns. And it is kind of, I think, within its development, it's very intentional to make sure that Black people do not have access to property in Roland Park. They can't live there, they can't rent there, they can't buy there. There's only a concession made for domestics. And that's it, kind of domestics broadly defined. So you could have a butler, you could have a driver, you could have a maid. But if they were Black, that was the only way that they could be there. So what's interesting to me about kind of Paige Glasser's story is that on the one hand, she is very much interested in the Roland Park Company, but there are these blips in the story where Black people are in fact kind of responding, Black people in Baltimore are responding to the development of Roland Park with their own developments that are intentionally Black, that are intentionally meant to attract the Black community that also desires sewers and suburban living, et cetera, you know. So you get Wilson Park, which is off of York Road. You get Morgan Park. There's, I'm blanking on the name of it. I think it's like Cherry Heights, somewhere off Bel Air Road. Like there are these different sort of Black communities that pop up that say, all right, we don't have to live there. As a matter of fact, we don't want to live there. We got our own stuff, our own money, our own interests, and we're gonna develop those and be very intentional as well. And I think that, of course, there's a whole conversation we can have about kind of like intra-community wealth politics.
Right.
But it's it's a conversation that isn't part of how we talk about Baltimore. You know, it kind of in the national media and even at times locally, like Baltimore is understood to have this almost longstanding history of Black nothingness almost. And yet, if you dig a little bit deeper, what you see is, I guess, what you ultimately know if you live in Baltimore, like Black people are figuring out how to create community, create culture, create in every way they can. And I think that is absolutely what gets lost in the way that the media has told stories about the city.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, and I would even say when you think about a lot of the emerging like activists, academics, pundits, you know, I think an emergence of folks for whom I think are taking the perspective that you're criticizing, the perspective that, you know, in the case of Baltimore, that Black people have just always been a perpetual kind of oppressed victim, you know, exclusively, as opposed to a people, you know, sentient people that figure out how to push back, you know, against the oppression that we face. And so this leads me to, you know, so taking that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then thinking about just the reflection on just activism in general, you know, both in Baltimore and just nationally, you know, because I mean, I would say that what you're describing extends in a really clear way to the kinds of activism work that is getting the most attention, really being rooted in a perspective where the underlying assumption is that Black people haven't done very much, and to whatever extent that Black folks have done anything, that it is not significant, right? That's kind of my sense of the kind of contemporary activism that is made most visible by corporate mainstream media. And even I would also argue in some of the more progressive academic and activist nonprofit spaces, even some of the most well-meaning. If you can just reflect on that, just give me your reflections on just your observations. You know, is that a pattern that you also see in connecting kind of what we talked about in terms of how Baltimore is rendered as the basis for how, you know, many people who see themselves as, again, wanting to make change are carrying that same perspective?
Yeah, I think that the tricky thing is, and I guess, you know, it's funny, I was talking with my class about this recently. I think that what's tricky is that the certainty and reality of systemic oppression and its impacts on Black communities is a story that both needs to be told and also sells very well, you know? And I think that what is tricky is figuring out how to navigate that. And I think it becomes trickier when the nonprofits or, you know, the folks with the money who are writing the checks need you to submit a proposal that reminds them about the systemic oppression, you know? And so that's the proposal that gets written. That's the documentary that gets made. That's the story that gets told, because in some respects, the funders have determined what their interests are that then influence the interests of the kind of creators, makers, activists. So, you know, I think that, I guess what I have been kind of wrestling with in some respects is like maybe understanding that balance between needing to have conversations that acknowledge what is, but also really realizing how marketable that is. And it has had me wondering, like, what happens when, or what would happen if there was almost a coup on the story, and instead of leaning into the kind of narrative of Black suffering, there were other ways of telling the stories of Black people that could engender the same amount of interest, the same amount of funding, the same amount of curiosity, you know? And I don't think that right now we know exactly what that looks like, you know, because I think there's so much emphasis on the tragedy and difficulty. You know, I'm teaching a class right now on Black joy. And I think that, I think what's interesting about the conversations that have come up in that class is that, you know, I think that on the one hand, there's this real need for, like, I don't know, happy Black stories. But I almost think that need is born out of the expectation that there are always sad Black stories. So like right. even the call for Black joy is like a counter argument to mm-hmm. what is understood to be normal, that like Black life is hard, difficult, and sucks. And if you're from Baltimore, my God, how is it that you make it? How is it that you live your life? How is it that, you know? And I think that is like an unfortunate way to think about it, because I think, you know, when I reflect on my own kind of research interests or how I approach, you know, something like Black joy in class, part of it is just leaning into the reality that I know a lot of Black people and they aren't always sad. And if they are sad, it's not necessarily because of systemic oppression. Mm-hmm. It might not have to do with white people at all. Mm-hmm. You know, like it might just be that life can be difficult sometimes. And so how do we also create space for that, you know, like,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, sounds like a big part of what I feel like, you know, I'm getting from what you're describing. And I imagine, you know, your background, you know, from a literary perspective, you know, there's something about like, you know, how is our imagination trained, you know? And is our imagination trained to think of Black people in ways that, you know, that like that joy would make sense, you know, in certain contexts, or even just that balance that you were describing as a thing to even know to try to understand and deal with properly. And I imagine, you know, you being a professor, I imagine that there's, you know, particularly so you deal with a lot of young people who are exposed to many of the narratives that you're describing. And so I guess a two-part question. One is, what's that like? Like, how are those narratives showing up? And what does that say? But, you know, yeah. Given, you know, what the narratives are that come up, you know, what does it say about what people think about Black people?
So I had I asked the class once. This was probably 2012-ish. I asked the class once if Black people could be creative. And I was being very intentionally pejorative, because what kind of question is that? Mm-hmm. Can Black people be creative? You know what I mean? But I wanted to, you know, like ruffle the feathers of my class a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I asked the question. And there's silence. And I'm a bit like, that's not the response I'm expecting. Why are they saying anything? And the silence lingers for entirely too long. And someone is bold enough to say, no, Black people can't be creative. And at this point, I'm horrified. I'm sitting in the classroom. I am Black, I would like to acknowledge. And so I'm like, where is this going? I don't even know. You know, it's funny, the young people today always want trigger warnings. Mm. And, you know, in class recently, I was like, well, let's think broadly about trigger warnings, because what y'all never do is warn me when you're about to say something crazy. They've never done that. They've never been like, Dr. Bynum, just so you know, I'm about to say some crazy mess right now. You know, like Black people can't be creative. So we end up having a conversation about what students mean by this. And it's multiple. It's many students who think this, not just one rogue, you know, thinker. No, no. It's like the classroom is in agreement. And
is it mostly Black? Is it mixed? Is it?
So I think it's a mixed classroom.
Okay.
It might still lean in terms of like majority to white students, but it's a lot of Black students in the class too. And they go on to explain, and this is still in an era where like keeping it real as a phrase is popular. Mm. So they explain to me that Black people keep it real, which is different to them than creative. So what they ultimately celebrate is that Black people are authentic. And it's that authenticity that is what they use to kind of name Black people's cultural contribution. So there's a truth telling, there's a realness to Black people, but like creativity is not available to Black people. All the while, I'm absolutely horrified by what it is that they have said. But I think like in my best moments, I'm really intrigued by what they're trying to observe. And I think that it is, you know, in some respects, so much born out of, I'm not going to say an inability to imagine Black people as being creative, but I almost think it's a leaning into a particular way of telling the story, because I think that for, at the very least, for my Black students in the room, if I was like, so you're not creative, you've not done a creative thing, I didn't call them out in that way, though, you know, that might have been an approach. But you know, I think that in these kind of academic settings, what oftentimes happens is, you know, kind of a whether it's realized or not, like a pronouncement of the media narrative, and not necessarily one that looks at all like what Black students' lives look like, my Black life looks like, or even for the white students who know Black people, like, you know, what them and their Black friends are capable of doing and thinking, you know. And I think it's not a fault of the imagination, but I almost think it's about kind of consuming American culture's understanding of what Blackness is and represents in, on the national stage, you know. And I feel like I've meandered away from your question, but your question kind of took me.
Yeah. And I think, and as you know, as we wrap, because a part of what you were describing in the scenario that you just gave, I mean, to me, is a part of what I think of as, you know, many of the most highly circulated narratives of people of African descent are often those of pathology. And oftentimes we don't see representations of Black people in mainstream spaces, either in arenas marked as high levels of civilization or outside of what collectively, I think the white imagination curates. And so I feel like, I mean, the story that you just kind of laid out is evidence of how young people, you know, soak that in. I mean, because the notion of Black people not being able to be creative, that only makes sense if the narratives that you've been fed about Black people make those rational beliefs, you know, because I think, I mean, to me, you know, the funniest part of that story is how irrational you knew that notion to be, but how rational to them it was.
Oh my gosh. I mean, I promise you I asked that question because I wanted them to be disgusted with me. You know, I wanted them to be like, what? You were talking crazy, Dr. Bynum? They did not do that to me at all. And so I was in there, like I said, mind blown. Like,
wow.
What have we're in an African American literature class. We've been reading stuff by Black people this whole semester. Like, are you telling me that I've been doing a bad job? Like, well, just say that, but don't make the entire Black community incapable of being creative. Like, just be like, you need to pick better books. You know? Mm-hmm. But that's not what they said.
Yeah. So what would you say? What would you say are some of the things, you know, again, as we try to conclude, like what would you say are some of the things that both in terms of the kinds of images or literature or media, like what are the kinds of things that folks should do to combat that? And particularly in your role as an educator, like what are some of the things people should do to combat that?
You know, I think that the one that comes most immediately to mind is born of my teaching this semester. So, like I said, I'm teaching this class on Black joy. And when I asked my class what Black joy was, there was a student who said that it was like where trauma didn't exist. And I was kind of like, is that how life works? And, you know, I sat with that and kind of continued to return to it as the semester has gone on. And, you know, it dawned on me that the kind of expectation of Black people's stories is somehow that you can have the joy without the pain, or you can have the story that has no tension. And yet, hey, that's not how stories work. You know, if I, you know, right now it's like my favorite peanut butter is Big Spoon Roasters. I really like it. Like, that's not a story. You know, that's a set of sentences. Right. Like, oh, okay, that's your favorite peanut butter. Now what? You know, like, did it attack you? Did it, like, did it do something? Like, so I guess when I think about, like, teaching Black people's stories in whatever way, and, you know, the literature professor in me thinks of everything as a story. So no matter what kind of classroom we're in, a math class, a political science class, an English class, a sociology class, a bio class, like all of them, it's all stories. So if we remember that the stories always have tension and narrative arc and like ups and downs, then I think that it becomes easier to explain Black life and explain that there are moments where joy happens in tandem with pain, where, you know, happiness comes from the striving, you know, and the striving might be against white supremacy. It might be within the community. It might be, you know, something familial that seems divorced from both the larger racial community, but also like white supremacy too. Like all of that is part of the human experience of being one's Black self and part of the Black community. And I think that if we remember that, then the kind of tragic elements of Black life don't have to become all consuming, so much so that you can only then talk about the joyful times. You know, like instead I would say that, you know, you need to be able to look at the protest and see that there's a joy in creating that community while also kind of recognizing the sadness of whatever events create the need for that particular kind of protest. You know, and I think if we kind of lean into the fact that Black people are fully capable of holding joy and pain, and not just because Frankie Beverly sung a song or Rob Day sampled it, but like, you know, we as a community have been able to do that, then I think that, like, I don't know, the world would open up to all kinds of stories and hear those stories differently and maybe a bit better than what I've seen so far. And certainly within Baltimore, because my God, I can only take so many questions about the imagined hardships I must have faced living and growing up in Baltimore. I mean, at the very least, I'm glad that the internet is really obsessed with the Baltimore accent now. Because I think it's funny, but at least they're not talking about, like, I don't know,
The Wire.
Yeah. Right. Like, yeah. Ask me to say two. That's fine. But yeah. Please don't ask me if I live on The Wire, next to The Wire, if I know where the orange couch is, you know.
Yeah. Well, look, this is something that we definitely should circle back to at some point. It's always a pleasure to talk to you about this. And, you know, and I think in a follow up, it'd be good to talk more in depth about some of the politics of it all, more directly. But I think, you know, just this piece about the way that pain and joy are come in tandem, I think is something that's really important for people to think about. Both in terms of storytelling and those who are watching that are engaged in political work, to just remember that those things come in tandem. So really appreciate you for dropping that. So as we wrap up, again, this is Davon Love, Director of Public Policy Leaders of Beautiful Struggle, again, with our guest, Dr. Tyra Bynum. Do you want to tell people how they can get in touch with you? Like that?
It's so funny. I have to be the person that's like, Google me. I'm at the University of Iowa. I have a website there, but I don't engage in social media in any way. So I can't be like at this or check me out here. You know, like it has to be the Google. But I will say I thank you for the opportunity to be part of this conversation, because I think it's certainly an important one. And kind of any opportunity to expand the discussion of what's happening in and around Baltimore is important.
Absolutely. So if you like conversations like this, continue to support In Search of Black Power, Project of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. You can find us on lbsbaltimore.com. You can find us on LBS Baltimore, all your relevant social media. Look up In Search of Black Power, where you can get this and other conversations like it. Again, this is Davon Love, Director of Public Policy Leaders of A Beautiful Struggle. And until next time, take care, safe travels. Peace.